So I ask permission, ask leave from the Sangha and the lay community to say a few words on this occasion of Magha Puja, full moon of February. And first to say Anumodana and thank you for arranging all these flowers in the shrine and for our offerings for the circumambulation this evening. The flowers are a symbolic of sila, of the virtue, and just like they make the shrine beautiful, the virtue, the sila, is something which beautifies the mind and the heart. Incense is the symbol of samadhi, the mental steadfastness, well-established mind. The candles are the panya, or the discernment. So this is Magha Puja, and there's some interesting backstory to this day, and it was when the Buddha taught a teaching known as the Avada Patimokkha. It's not to be confused with the Patimokkha that we recite, the 227 bhikkhus rules that we recited earlier today, that Ajahn Kachana recited in Pali. So, but the Avada Patimokkha, Avada means just exhortation, or it can be thought of as like a teaching, but more commonly translated as like exhortation. And Patimokkha meaning pati, meaning like like a training or like a source or a like a training. Mokkha meaning like a leading out. So leading out of dukkha, leading out of dissatisfaction, leading out of stress, leading out of suffering. So the exhortation, the teaching given was the exhortation on the way out. You could translate it as that. And this was an occasion where the teaching was given at the Veluvanarama, which is the bamboo grove. And this was the very first Buddhist monastery ever. And it was offered to the Sangha by King Bimbisara of Magadha. And this particular monastery was offered because of a promise or a request made by King Bimbisara of the Bodhisatta just after he'd left home. So just after the prince Siddhartha Gautama had left the palace, he had shaved off his hair and beard on the banks of the river Anoma on the eastern edge of the kingdom of Kosalan country. And he had to go into the next kingdom, the kingdom of Magadha, so that his own people couldn't pursue him into that kingdom. So he crossed the river Anoma out of the kingdom of Kosala and into kingdom of Magadha, and that's where he took on the ochre robes and became a wandering ascetic known as the ascetic Gautama. But still very strong, not yet in his austere practices, so still in the beginning of his going forth, still very noble looking, very strong, and very tall, and very regal. And so he was going alms round in the very beginning of his practice and getting his bearings in what it was meaning to be a monk, to be an ascetic. and the people in the villages were sort of in awe of him. Normally, an ascetic or a renunciate would probably not be that upright, that regal looking. So it's unusual for someone of that stature to take on the ascetic's life. And so word of that there was this new ascetic in town, the ascetic Gotama, quickly reached King Bimbisara, who wanted to go see him. And so they went to go see him, and the Bodhisatta, the ascetic Gotama, sitting at the foot of a tree, and King Bimbisara being very taken by his presence, and so approaching him. And so this is within the first months, or at the very least the first year of his practice, even before going to see his teachers, his first teachers, Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta. And so King Bimbisara says, well, you're someone who obviously has barami, spiritual qualities, spiritual cultivation, and your demeanor is bright and regal, and I feel like you should be the king of this kingdom. You're higher than me. And he, on the spot, offers his kingdom to this ascetic. He says, I offer you the kingdom. And the ascetic Gotama responds. He says, I just relinquished a kingdom. I was set to become a king, so I just relinquished a kingdom. I'm not about to take on another one. And he says, all I want is the deathless. You could offer me the whole world, and I wouldn't accept it. And so King Bimbisara, being even more inspired, then says, well, if you attain this goal you're seeking, please remember me. I'd like to be one of your first disciples. And so the ascetic Gotama, the Bodhisatta, just nods in assent. And so now coming up to after the enlightenment, the Buddha remembered that, and one of the very early on made his way back to the Magadhan kingdom. And then King Bimbisara then offered this first monastery, the Bamboo Grove. So after the Buddha's awakening, of course, as most people know, the story was he's sitting under the Bodhi tree thinking about who could possibly understand this teaching. And once he decides to turn the wheel of the Dhamma, he makes his way to, realizes the five ascetics who were with him previously might be able to understand the teaching. So he makes his way to the deer park in Benares, near Benares. And that's the where they spend the first rains retreat after the Buddha's enlightenment. So the first rains retreat is spent together with the five ascetics, and as the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is given, Kondanya reaches stream entry and becomes known as Anya Kondanya, and then the Buddha teaches them in stages throughout the Vasa, and by the end they've all become arhants. So after that Vasa, the Buddha, considering what's his next move, he's still hanging around there at the deer park, and the next group of disciples is Yasa. Yasa is also a rich householder, almost prince-like, who decides to leave the household life in search of something unworldly, something better, comes across the Buddha. And then 30 of Yasa's friends come and also become monks. They all become arhants. So Yasa's father comes looking for him. He becomes the first layman to take refuge in the triple gem. Yasa's mother comes looking. She becomes the first laywoman to take refuge in the triple gem. So you see the Sangha getting going at this point. Then the Buddha makes his way to Gaya Sisa, to Gaya Head, teaches the Kassapa brothers, who have a large entourage. They all become bhikkhus, the fire worshippers. Buddha gives the fire sermon. You got 1,000 arhants from that. So then he makes his way to Magadha, even before the second Vasa. So already he's had a humongous impact in the northern Indian region. And King Bimisara meets up with him, offers him the bamboo grove. As far as I know, the Buddha never spent the Vasa in the bamboo grove, but he assigned different disciples to stay there, and the Buddha came and went from there, used it as a way place. So, full moon of February, it seems to have been this occasion where the Buddha was dwelling at the bamboo grove, and there during the cold season, and 1,250 arhants, it's known as I'm probably going to get this Pali term wrong, the Chaturanga Sannipat, which is the great fourfold coming together of these 1,250 bhikkhus. And they all had four things in common, which was they were all ordained directly by the Buddha with the Ehi Bhikkhu ordination. And so meaning that when they met with the Buddha simply said, "Come bhikkhu," and that was their ordination. And they all were arhants. And they all showed up spontaneously without prior arrangement. So they didn't have cell phones, they didn't have email, and they didn't get a little ping in their pocket or whatever. They didn't get a text to come together. But they also had the fourth thing they all had in common was they all had the full range of psychic powers. So we take it on faith that they intuitively knew the Buddha was, they knew somehow the Buddha was at the bamboo grove, and they knew to sort of gravitate there all at the same time. So the Buddha gives this teaching, and you might think, why would he need to teach 1,250 arhants? They don't need to be taught anything. They're already finished their work. There's nothing left to be done. But this teaching is important that the Buddha is consolidating the path into a very short teaching, easy to understand, easy to practice. Well, actually, really difficult to practice, but easy to understand, and we can easy to memorize. And we'll just go through it in somewhat briefly for the talk tonight before the circumambulation. So the famous first part of this teaching, the Kanti Paramang Tapo Titika, Tapo is the word tapas. That means like spiritual fire. That was a very popular term in the time of the Buddha among the ascetics, where there was this sense of building up through practices like fasting and meditating for days on end, building up spiritual fire in the mind in order to either overcome the body or attain some stage of meditation. So building up this sense of tapas, spiritual fire, and the Buddha saying the ultimate tapas, the ultimate fire, spiritual fire that burns out the defilements, is patient endurance, so that showing that that's the very thing to be focused on, the very thing to be cultivated, not other kinds of tapas, not other kinds of fire. So the spiritual fire that we're cultivating is the kanti. Kanti is the paramang. Paramang is the highest. So kanti is the highest tapas, the highest kind of fire. So endurance, what do we have to endure? Ovada that Ajahn Kurunadamo was giving at our Patimokkha today. So we normally have a brief teaching or exhortation just to the Sangha, to the monastic Sangha, when we have our Patimokkha. And Ajahn Kurunadamo was bringing up the sense of patient endurance, the Lungpo Samedo translation of that, or the definition being the ability to be with that which is unpleasant. It's not gritting our teeth and bearing things or trying to wait until it's over, but it's the ability to be fully present with that which is undesired or unpleasant, with dukkha. So we cultivate patient endurance with our life in general, because the whole path of our life is Buddhism gets a bad rap because of this, but it's actually true. Our life is just one difficulty after another, and I guess as we get older, we see how true that is. However, the patient person has happiness within that, so we're cultivating patient endurance with aging. We're enduring sickness. We're enduring death. We're enduring separation from the loved. We're enduring contact with that which is disliked, that which is not loved, contact with criticism. We're enduring not getting what we want. When we have to endure just having a body and mind, having a body which comes into contact with heat and cold, rain and sun, we're constantly trying to make ourselves comfortable. That, and we have to endure that. And then a mind which is just, I don't know about anybody else's mind, but my own mind, I could say, it's just like a storm sometimes, just the having to endure just being with this mind. So the storm of the body and the mind, but rather than constantly trying to get away from suffering, constantly trying to run away from pain, constantly trying to distract ourselves from our own mind, then actually being present with it and enduring it, and that's the tapo, that's the spiritual fire that we're cultivating. Nibbanang paramang vadanti buddha, that's the Nibbana is supreme, Nibbana is the highest, say the Buddhas. So that's Nibbana, and that comes after the phrase about tapo, the spiritual fire. And Nibbana is the cooling of all fires, the cooling, the great cooling down of the mind. So you see the beauty of the Pali in this. It's impossible to translate it into English to fully capture it. It's the the Buddha's talking about cultivating great spiritual fire, and then he's talking about putting it all out, cooling down completely. And then he goes on to say just these very basic teachings about harmlessness, about and a wanderer or a spiritual practitioner, someone who's taken ordination, what defines them is this sense of harmlessness and also not troubling others, so right livelihood, so not being a burden on others, not troubling others, having this sense of aloofness from the world. And that's what defines the samana, that's what defines the one gone forth, is this sense of harmlessness, not being a burden, modesty, contentment. This phrase, matanyuta chabatasaming, that's knowing one's measure at the meal. So this is another really core part of the monastic life. It's just that simple act of eating, so much insight can be had, so much can be achieved if we just view the meal in the right way. Like the Buddha saying in other in the suttas, that if you truly understand food, like the nutriment of physical food, you either attain to being a non-returner or an arhant. Because when you fully understand food, then you fully understand the whole range of sensuality. Or like contemplating the food is just earth element, just something for keeping the body going. This also harkens back to that first meeting that the Bodhisattva had with King Bimbisara, because that's when he was having insight into how to relate to the food. The ascetic Gotama, his first alms round, where he first went through the village and gathered food and was going to eat his first meal as a wanderer, as not as a prince. And he's looking and everything's all mixed together, all the food's all mixed together, and he reflects that never in his life has he eaten in such a way, has he eaten things all mixed together, but he feels this is appropriate for an ascetic, for one seeking the deathless. That's where the meal reflection comes from. So he makes the aditana, the determination at that point to always use alms food, not for fun, not for pleasure, not for building up bulk, not for beautification, but only for the maintaining the holy life so he can keep practicing. So that comes out in the Ovada Parimokkha, the importance of viewing food in the appropriate way, the proper way, knowing one's measure. And it's really clear the Buddha doesn't say abstaining from food completely, which was a practice that he undertook during his initial seeking the path, his initial training. So he doesn't say fasting or abstaining from food, but he just says knowing the right amount, knowing what's enough. Then we have the phrase, which is translated in the chanting, retreating to a lonely place, which kind of sounds depressing. I think the seeking solitude, commitment to solitude, that's what's being pointed to. Sitting and lying down in a secluded dwelling place or in a secluded location. There's a phrase in the suttas where the Buddha's talking about the ideal dwelling places for people gone forth. He says, secluded dwellings, far from human habitation, frequented by cool breezes, these I praise. So we can have this sense of gratitude. That's what we have here at Abhayagiri. We're going to get some of the best secluded dwelling places out of anywhere here, out of any monastery that I know of. It's one of the benefits of being in America, is it's actually illegal to make too much noise at night. It's a stark contrast to being in monasteries in Asia, where pretty hard to get away from the karaoke, even on the weekdays. But here we've got these beautiful forest, mountainside, kind of rugged terrain, quiet, frequented by cool breezes. Good for practice. Commitment to the higher mind, adi chitte cha ayogo. So that's like yoga, binding, yoking yourself to the higher mind. The heightened consciousness, heightened way of thinking. So this is really points to the core of the training, where we're looking at our own mind and heart, training ourselves in a way that is different than we would perhaps live in the world, where we're always looking outside of ourselves. So adi chitta is like you're looking in rather than out. And this is like in the suttas, I think it's in the Dhammapada, where the Buddha says that the one who conquers himself is more of a hero than one who can conquer 1,000 armies outside of himself. Or if we can crumble away the mountain of our views and opinions, that's more powerful than changing the views and opinions of other people. That's a different way of thinking. That's the heightened consciousness, the consciousness that leads to the end of suffering, leads to lessening of clinging, and leads to a different mode of thinking, a different frame of mind that we can get into. That's what they call the heightened mind. So it's just this very short teaching. The Buddha's only given this teaching. It only takes just a minute or two to give this teaching. And it's really a distillation of what all of the Buddhas point at, which is this commitment to the higher mind, these very elemental practices and ways of being in the world. It's nothing complicated. He didn't give a 5-week exposition on Abhidhamma at that time, or on all of the possible cittasikas. He just said, knowing the measure with the meal, commit to solitude, patient endurance. There you go. Go do it. This is it. This is the teaching. So I'll just leave it at that for this.